Hi, everybody. Steve Savitsky. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today we have Carol Green Unger, who lives in Israel. Carol, how are you?
Thank God.
So how did you come to write this beautiful article in the Jewish Action about the latke, the little-known story behind the latke?
Well, I've actually gotten very into Jewish food and its history and mystical meaning because I've been working on a cookbook which is due out in another year, which is called Jewish Soul Food. It's called Jewish Food and its Mystical Meaning. I kind of got interested in the idea that there are meanings behind our foods. Like, our foods aren't just randomly selected, and there's a lot of interesting stories to our foods. Some of them relate to mysticism, some of them relate to history, and I've spent, you know, probably more than a year, you know, researching this and digging this up.
What other foods did you, besides, we'll get into the latke in one moment, what other foods did you find that were interesting that have more spiritual significance?
Well, I actually started this whole journey with carrot semis. Like, my mother is a Hungarian Holocaust survivor, and she's not so well now, so she's not, you know, cooking anymore, but during her many cooking years, she's a fabulous cook, and she was always very traditional in her cooking, and we weren't Satmar Hasidim, but I think we ate that kind of cuisine. So I remember that she always used to make carrot semis for Rosh Hashanah, and we never did anything ceremonial or anything like that. And when I moved to Israel, I discovered that carrot semis is called merin, and it's a symbol, it's a siman. It goes along with this whole simanim thing, and it's a segula for prosperity. The carrots are cut in rounds. It used to be in the Middle Ages, the carrots were actually golden, and they were fairly scarce. Now they're much more common, and they're more orangey, copper-colored. But in those days, carrots actually looked like gold coins, and people would eat this on the table as a, you know, symbol for prosperity, because there's this idea of eating auspicious foods at the new year, you know, as simanim. And it occurred to me that this has been going on for many thousands of years. And from that, kind of one thing led to another. And I found many of our traditional foods have these kinds of stories, like Rosh Hashanah foods and latkes. Right. Like, a lot of Jewish foods kind of tell the Jewish story. Like, it's not, like, it seems like today, I mean, I'm not trying to blast Jamie Geller or Susie Fishbein. I think that, you know, they're wonderful people, and they, you know, they have, you know, great cookbooks. But in a way, there's a move toward, I don't want to call it culinary assimilation, but in a way, that's really what it is. People are moving outwards and exploring other kinds of cuisines, and that's, you know, all very exciting, and in a lot of ways, there are health benefits and, you know, whatever. Now we're trying to cut down on cholesterol. I can see advantages to, you know, having a wider range of vegetables that maybe they didn't have in shtetl times, or in, you know, in Eastern Europe, or in the, you know, older years of the Middle East, wherever people used to come from. But there's a trade-off, and in not eating a lot of our traditional foods, sort of forsaking them, we're losing out on the message, because, you know, we, as Jews, we like to put meaning in everything. I mean, it's not only, you know, the bracha before and after, but sometimes it's even the food itself that, you know, is included in our story, and a lot of these stories are kind of reflect core Jewish values. So, and they also just, they add a lot of fun to the holidays for kids. They really create memories. You know, like having the appropriate foods is something that really sticks in people's consciousness. Like, you know, they joke about stomach Jews, you know, whose only identity is from their stomach, but that's actually kind of a powerful connection. I mean, maybe it's not the end point that, you know, you would want for your children or something like that, but it's certainly a starting place, and it's a very, you know, meal times are very emotional. It's a time when the family gets together, and you know, it's a lot of people's warmest memories come from meals and from eating, and you know, these kinds of foods, things like latkes and farfel and simis, and, you know, there's also some Sephardic recipes. There's also, I have a large selection of challahs, that there's a tradition of making challahs in all sorts of really, really interesting shapes to, you know, for different holidays. Like, there's a challah that the Sephardic Jews make for Purim, and they actually insert hard-boiled eggs into the challahs, and they're supposed to be Haman's eyes, and they take out the eyes of the Suda. Like, I mean, to me, that, as a child, to remember that, that must be so fun. You know, so a lot of these, you know, they talk about continuity crisis and all this and invest a lot of money in Jewish education. I personally think that, you know, beefing up the meals and having a lot of these really fun things happening is a really great way to create, like, you know, a sort of an inner connection to one's heritage without, you know, getting very...
So you've done some interesting things. It sounds like you're kind of looking at a new area that people haven't really concentrated on. And the article really talks about the latke, since the Jewish Action is going to be out for the Hanukkah edition, the winter edition 2013. Let's talk a little bit about the latke, which today everybody talks about the oil. So where did that start from, the fact that we should commemorate because of the menorah and so on, I guess, and then what happened from there?
I don't really have a clear history on when it was that people started eating oily foods. The earliest source that I came up with, which actually was given by Rabbi David Meisels, who's a rabbi in Brooklyn who's probably the biggest expert on this stuff around, comes from the father of the Rambam, where he seems to have written a letter rebuking his community not to slight the idea of eating oily foods on Hanukkah, because it seems like people were doing this from, like, way beyond. Like, frying is a very ancient, is one of the oldest cooking techniques, like, known to man. Like, baking, the way we know it, is more recent, but frying is something that's been going on, you know, for centuries. It probably went on, you know, with the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans. And there were things that were sort of like proto-latkes that people used to make, but they weren't made of potato. Like, the early, there were, you know, kind of dough fritters, which the Moroccan Jews actually still make until today. They call them svinj or a svinj. That's their, it's kind of a beignet, like a kind of a yeasty fried dough, sort of a, like a cruller, like you would, like they sell
right.
in state fairs.
But you mentioned a person, interesting person. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Antoine Augustin Parmentier. And he seemed to be a one-man PR for potatoes. How did that happen?
Well, the story behind that potato is actually a really fascinating story. I mean, somebody could probably write a book about that. But apparently he was a prisoner of war in that, I think it was the 30 Years' War. He was a Frenchman, and he was taken by the Prussians. And in Prussia, they were eating potatoes, but people were very reluctant to eat potatoes in those days, until the mid-19th century, people really were not eating potatoes at all. So this was back, I think, in the 18th century, and he was a prisoner, and so prisoners were kind of considered subhuman, so they fed them potatoes, and he discovered that he didn't die from these potatoes, which everyone else considered to be poisonous. He actually managed to thrive, and he was a prisoner of war for quite a number of years, and when he came back, he was a chemist, and I suppose a scientist, to the extent he put out scientific papers, and he sort of became a potato popularizer. He took the sun as his mission, and then this, you know, this kind of caught on, like Frederick the Great. I don't think I mentioned him in the article. He was also of potatoes, and he encouraged potato cultivation. People were very reluctant because they objected because they said potatoes weren't mentioned in the Bible. This is non-Jews, and you know, there was a lot of initial reluctance, and eventually he kind of pushed this through. I mean, he was sort of heavy-handed, and he forced it through. And to this day, people go to his grave and they leave potatoes there, which is really unbelievable.
Where is this? Where is the grave? Where's the grave?
I think it's somewhere in Prussia. So in Germany, contemporary Germany, which is, I've never been, but I, you know, in my research, I came up with this, and I thought this was really fascinating. But what was really interesting was the fact that the potato, in a way, was you know, there was tremendous siyata d'shamaya in this story, in that there were crop failures in Eastern Europe, and the grain crops failed, and then this potato, which had come over from the Americas, the explorers had discovered it, because in Colombia, people were eating potatoes. You know, in South America, this was a popular food, and the explorers brought it over and eventually it caught on. And potatoes are much easier to cultivate. They have many more growing seasons than grain crops, and they can be cultivated on smaller swatches of land. So this kind of took on, and it forestalled starvation. Starvation was a huge problem. There were always huge shortages. Like when the grain crops failed, there'd be starvation and people would die. And now all of a sudden they were planting these potatoes, and the Jewish population actually exploded in this time on account of potatoes. There was, you know, in the shtetl, there was this joke, you know, Sunday potatoes, Monday potatoes, Tuesday potatoes. It was like a children's rhyme. But in a way, the potato was the, you know, tool that Hashem gave us to kind of keep Eastern European Jewry alive through this period. And it was kind of natural that the latke evolved into a potato. What? Hello?
Well, I thought it was fascinating also, in the article, you talk about the nutritional value of the potato, which, you know, I don't know if people really understand that. According to your article, you say, except for calcium, vitamin A, vitamin D, it basically has every other essential vitamin and mineral. And so instead of the one a day, you know, your vitamin, you take one little potato and you're okay.
Yeah, I don't know if firing it is the best thing. I mean, it's nice for Hanukkah, but I don't know if I'd recommend latkes as an everyday, you know, food. But potatoes are, you know, they have fiber, they have vitamin C, they have lots of vitamins and minerals. They're supposed to be good for you. That's what they say. They say that
well, they're good for you, but no one tells you have to have them with oil. I mean, I guess if
what?
You have them without the
yeah,
oil, it's a little bit better. But right. Well, no, look, for Hanukkah, listen, for Hanukkah, there's no question about it. There's nothing we won't do for Hanukkah. And you talk about the fact that, first of all, I wonder whether, like, the Jews who lived in South America, because there were Jews there, I wonder whether they actually, you know, made potato latkes in those days. We'll probably never know that. But we do know that that then it came to Europe, and then eventually, when you talk about the shores of America, eventually you say that in one of the earliest Jewish cookbooks published in Cincinnati in 1889, there's actually a recipe for latke. And so there we go, right there. So, and it's interesting also in your article, besides giving the history, you give, now this recipe, is this your own personal recipe or is this a family recipe or what?
This is the one I use. I mean, it's kind of adapted from Levana Kirshenbaum's latkes recipe because I like her recipe, but it's just whatever. It's not exactly hers. It's not exactly mine. It's just whatever. It's just kind of evolved over the years as the one that I do. But
you would recommend it? You would recommend this one?
I think it's good. I if you want good latkes, you know, just like pan frying or baking is not going to do it. So if you want them to really taste good, you have to go whole hog and you have to deep fry, and it's a lot of oil. And but, you know, Hanukkah's not every day, and you don't have to do it
this
every night
true.
Either.
This is also true. So now, how did they get from there, I guess, to the Sufganiyot? I guess because, once again, it's the oil. Is that what it is?
Sufganiyot is also the oil. Sufganiyot is kind of another, Sufganiyot is another sort of evolution that happened. But Sufganiyot actually have their origin in something that the non-Jews used to make around for Christmas. They used to make something similar, and that kind of got transformed into a Jewish oily Hanukkah thing. And Jews have been making, like, oily fritters and various, like I told you about the Sephardic one. There's also something called bimuelos. There's a lot of different names in the Sephardic world. So there's a lot of, like, you know, fritters fried in oil. That's like a very old tradition. And there were also latkes in the old days before the cultivation of the potato. Latkes were made out of buckwheat flour. And,
oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, they were made, and they were fried in schmaltz. There's actually an original recipe, and Joan Nathan has a French Jewish cookbook, and she's actually got a recipe for something called gratinés, which I think is a really authentic medieval recipe of latkes with onions and fried in schmaltz. So I think without the schmaltz, the buckwheat is just
sounds
nice
like a cardiologist delight, you know.
They say schmaltz is not as terrible, but I wouldn't make these into everyday food. As I said, I'm also pretty health conscious, and I'm not encouraging people to you know, change. I think, you know, you have to, these things have to be eaten in proportion. This is not.
So when is your when
it, what?
When is your book going to be coming out? Yeah, when is your book going to be coming out?
As Rat Hashem, it should be out for not this coming Hanukkah, but the following Hanukkah.
Okay, so, what's it going to be called?
Jewish soul food.
Jewish soul food. Okay.
Jewish
sounds
soul,
good.
Yeah, the idea is that there's a real soul connection in Jewish food. It's Jewish food and its mystical meaning, Jewish soul food.
Terrific,
yeah.
Wonderful. Well, listen, it's been great talking to you, and I'm sure the people out there are going to find it fascinating reading the article, then listening to the interview. Carol Green Unger, living in Eretz Yisrael, who is a full-time mother but a freelance writer, and I'm sure we'll enjoy the book when it comes out. Look forward to talking to you again. Maybe if you have some other interesting products or interesting history of other Jewish foods, we'll take a look. We'll see what we can do. So have a great day.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so
have
much.
Great
okay,
day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.